trying to build something new and telling people what you're doing is hard. But we know as journalists that you don't give up on the first, hey, I'm sorry, I don't want to talk to you guys. You got to keep going. And that I think that's why journalists make good business people in many ways, because we don't give up.
Welcome to the Beyond the Newsroom podcast, where we talk with guests about, you guessed it, life after news. I'm one of your hosts, Lou Dubois.
And I'm Diana Alvear. And we're two former NBC News colleagues turned real life friends, now building careers in new industries. But we'll always be journalists at heart.
And storytellers. And on this podcast, you'll be hearing story after story from other journalists who've gone on to find professional success and happiness in new places.
All right, let's go. Claire Atkinson is a British-born writer who has covered the global media business from both sides of the Atlantic for the past two decades. Her uber-impressive background includes stops at many of the trades like Ad Age, The Hollywood Reporter, and Variety, before moving on to the business desk at the New York Post, followed by NBC News, and then Business Insider. She recently branched out on her own, launching her own Substack and podcast, The Media Mix, to continue covering the media industry from a truly global perspective. So Claire, super excited to have you and welcome to Beyond the Newsroom.
Thanks for having me. I should also mention that my stints at Hollywood Reporter and Variety were freelance gigs many, many years ago. I actually was on board at Hollywood Reporter when Princess Diana died and covered that, which is a long time ago. But yes, definitely have written on lots of the trade magazines in every little corner of the media business, from covering public relations to advertising to broadcasting and cable, where I covered local TV stations and the ad business, advertising age, that was all about the ad agencies. So yeah, I've kind of like watched the media business for literally the past 25 years, and it's always changing, and that's what makes it a really fun beat to be on.
I'm going to come back to that since you mentioned it. And I think, by the way, first, you're our first international guest, which I'm really excited about. So let's go back. You talked about being a freelancer. So you moved to New York. You were born and raised in England, right? And came to New York, as you describe it, as a penniless freelancer, which I thought was a great description. So tell our listeners a little bit about what drew you to the industry to start out with.
Yeah, that's a great question. I moved to the States in 1998. And before that, I had written on a lot of trades that involved me speaking to lots of Americans, because I was writing about the emergence and the growth of kind of like the overseas market for American television shows. And in the 90s, what was happening was the Berlin Wall came down in the early 90s. And then what happened was communist TV stations that had previously programmed ballet were all of a sudden looking at competition from commercial stations that were looking for telenovelas and Dallas and Dynasty and exciting American shows. So in my world, I got to speak to lots of Hollywood guys, international programming people. And in some ways that gave me a taste for America and gave me an idea of what it was all about. I traveled on that in that role, and I went to lots of television program markets in the States. And I always kind of felt like if you were an ambitious person and you wanted to do well in journalism, that New York was really the capital of ambition, and that I had to be there in some way if I wanted to further my career and, you know, go beyond London, which was really the capital of the media world in Britain. And you know, all my friends were in the media. It's a kind of a small world. And I was more intrigued, having been an international editor on a magazine and traveled, I was interested to see it up close for myself, but I didn't actually have a job to go to. And so came over to New York as kind of an international correspondent, working for Media Week magazine back home and writing about the American media landscape from the very get-go. And so when I first arrived in the States, I literally didn't have a steady income. I say penniless, I literally was, that my roommate had a jar of pennies that he collected, and I would go in there for bagels when I didn't get a paycheck. You know, it was a test of my mettle from the beginning, because, you know, what I did was I called successful people in New York and said, will you talk to me? And I'd be told, you know, well, who are you? And I didn't really have much of a gig. And so I would kind of do this hustle where I'd say, you know, I'm really interested to talk to you for the Guardian or the Observer newspaper in the UK. And then I'd tell those publications, hey, this famous person would really like to be in your publication. So I had to do the old freelance arbitrage for a while. And, you know, what it instills in you is that idea of journalism being about hustle. You've got to hustle on every side of the business. And, you know, being freelance teaches you a lot about how to manage your time, money, making sure that what you're doing has a productive outcome. You know, as a freelancer, you can spend lots of time doing great stories, but if the editor on the desk has a friend who would prefer to do that story instead of you, then your story is going to get killed. And that happened to me multiple times. You know, you do the work and then the story goes nowhere and you never see the fee. So yeah, that was kind of how I got started.
I love hearing your story. And again, welcome, Claire. We're so excited to talk to you. I mean, ask Lou, like, how excited I was when he's like, there's this woman named Claire and he told me about you. And I was like, yes, we have to talk to her. And I just want to tell you, you're so right. I think the one thing that everybody that works in the news industry understands is you're literally hungry. I mean, sometimes I wasn't paid enough in my first job to eat dinner, you know? And I was like, I'm hungrier to make it than I am to afford a sandwich. Yeah. So I jive with that. So something that has stood out to me about the trajectory of your career is that you have been front and center to how the internet has changed the industry. I mean, you started when it was just kind of, I mean, if you're saying you were covering Princess Diana, that was what, 1997, I think I remember. And so you really have had a front seat to how the internet has changed everything so completely. And I wanted to ask you about, you know, this is a little bit of a complex question, but what to you have you seen been the benefits and then the consequences of the internet becoming so closely intertwined with the news industry?
Yeah, well, I guess the biggest benefit is distribution, and that you can be read by people in Australia or, you know, anywhere around the world, your story can travel and have impact. And I think, you know, if you're the New York Times or you're NBC News or you're the Guardian or whomever, your geographic location is one thing, but your audience can be anywhere and it can be huge. And I think, you know, the New York Times success in being a very popular subscription destination has kind of is proof that you don't have to be in New York to want to read the New York Times. And I think, you know, that's one of the great benefits of the internet, is that all of these companies and platforms, whether it's Google or it's Meta and Facebook and Twitter, gives you a global platform for whatever you're doing. And of course, the downside of that for many of these businesses has been that, you know, the algos control your business, and it's hard for people to keep up. And I think, you know, BuzzFeed has been a victim of this, that, you know, you think you understand like what it takes to make something viral or to engage a huge audience in something. And then somebody tweaks the algo and then suddenly your audience dips and you don't know why. And then your revenue starts to decline. And I think, you know, that's been the big conundrum. And, you know, I spent 3 years in Insider, which was an amazing digital first publication. And what you learn there is that, you know, Google SEO is everything, and that's search engine optimization, and that you need to write headlines that are not those kind of amazingly amusing headlines that you see at the New York Post. They have a completely different purpose. And the purpose in many ways is to answer a question that somebody might ask in a Google search box so that your stories can be discovered. And so that's one of the big changes. And our headlines would be really long. And I would be like, you know, what about this? It's shorter and punchier and, you know, it might capture the imagination more. And, you know, often I would find that the kinds of headlines that we would put on stories that would generate audiences had very little to do with that. It was about putting yourself in that mindset of what somebody would be searching for and how they would get the answer to that question. And that answer had to be in some ways in your headline. And you know, that's common across all newsrooms right now. Traffic is everything. Subscriber numbers are everything. And that's really radically changed the business of journalism.
It's a really great point. And I'm going to stick on the internet just for a second, because I think what you called out, you know, ultimately the internet's changing every day, every week, every month. I listened to your podcast last week where you talked about Threads, which 10 days on, who knows where it's going to be now versus where it was 10 days ago. But, you know, I think you're 100% right. It's always evolving. And I think it's funny to hear you talk about headlines, because we've had folks from the New York Post who, you know, headlines are what makes the New York Post, right? We've had folks from BuzzFeed who in many ways changed the game when it comes to internet searches and things to your SEO conversation. I'd be curious, you know, as you've kind of moved around and had these different steps in your career, what's kept you motivated in sort of the work that you do? Because I think it's a really fascinating world, and always thought this was fascinating, the world of media covering media. So I'd love to hear a little bit more, you know, sort of what kept you going as all these changes were happening.
Yeah, that's a really good one. I mean, the tricky part of being a media reporter at a big conglomerate is that you're always writing about your boss's business, and that can be stressful. And, you know, I think we saw that at CNN recently, where Oliver Darcy, who's their media correspondent, was writing about Chris Licht and the reaction to the Donald Trump town hall. And his job was to write about what his colleagues and what the industry was saying. And that's oftentimes in conflict with what your boss wants you to be saying. So, you know, I was at the New York Post writing about Rupert Murdoch's backyard. And he's up there on, you know, one of the floors, and I'm on another. And, you know, it's what makes it super interesting. I covered Roger Ailes' exit from the company and, you know, the Me Too accusations at both Fox News. And
Claire, I have to know, did you ever hear from Rupert about your reporting? Because now I'm like, whoa, what happened?
No, I would never hear from him directly. And I never really knew what he thought about what I was doing, but obviously he would make calls to my boss's boss's boss. So, but I was never directly asked to do one thing or another. And, you know, it was intriguing that, you know, most people read stuff into your reporting as if, you know, Rupert's on the phone with you telling you what to write or giving you tips, and you're kind of stabbing around in the dark, and people read things into what you're writing and presume that, you know, I'm channeling Rupert's thought process. And that was not the case whatsoever. You know, I went out there and I had lunches and met bankers and private equity people and PR people and lawyers and tried to figure out what was going on for myself. But I mean, the media industry is fascinating, it's ever changing. And so, you know, the communications industry has a very broad definition these days. And when I say I write about media, you're writing about everything from what's happening in Hollywood to what's happening in Threads to the, you know, the tech business and Twitter. And it's all kind of converged together. And my podcast, The Media Mix, is aiming to kind of capture that. It's media, tech, marketing, and where all these businesses kind of collide, and more they are one and the same.
You know what I find so interesting about what you're saying is that it does feel like things are accelerating. You know, the business side of things when it comes to the media, the fact that you're seeing more and more news outlets clustered in very few hands, the machinations, all this kind of stuff. Now the presence of AI, it's moving so quickly. I applaud you for trying to like make sense of it. Yeah. But this is all happening at the same time when there really does seem to be this exodus of people who are like, I can't do this anymore. Like, you know, the rank and file, the people who are actually filing the reports and putting the news together and stuff. We hear, I mean, this is why we created this podcast, was because so many people were burned out and were like, how did you get out? And what are you doing now? So I worry, and I think Lou worries too, because we love journalism. We loved journalism. That's why we went into it. But it really does seem like it's becoming unsustainable for the actual people who produce the news. What is your take on that?
Yeah, I mean, there are so many things to talk about, right? I mean, AI could just be one of them. The commodification of news. Do we need journalists to write up press releases that have been written by AI? I mean, you can see a world where AI is rewriting the AI written press release. I mean, that's kind of like mind blowing. And, you know, I spent a long time writing about layoffs across the media sector at the end of my time at Insider. It was very depressing. But you have these, I mean, as a business journalist, I think it's natural for these contractions to happen, and then there's an expansion and then a contraction. And I think that post-COVID, what we saw is everybody being extremely online and extremely interested in streaming and Netflix and news, and, you know, the Trump years, I guess, ballooned what everybody was interested in terms of like the politics and the future of democracy. And I think, you know, post-Trump and post-COVID, there's this kind of natural shrink back, advertisers saying we need to see where the recession is going, where the economy is going. And then, I mean, my sense, having been to a big advertising event recently in Cannes, where all the advertisers came together, is that things will look better in 24, that these advertisers will start loosening the purse, and hopefully that will trickle down to the media companies. Right now, as you said, it looks pretty bleak. And, you know, what we've seen over the past year or two is the increase of newsrooms unionizing and saying, you know what, we've seen inflation erode our pay packets, and we want to make sure that we're protected. And those unions, you know, they were active at Insider, they were active at Gannett, they're active at the New York Times, and you, Condé Nast, you see it more and more that journalists at the bottom of the pay scale are saying, we want protection. And, you know, rightly so. I've been writing about the bankruptcy of Vice recently. What we saw there were people going out and hiring cameras and paying baggage fees on airlines on their own credit cards and being unable to get their expenses back. When at the same time, like literally a day after the Wall Street Journal wrote that Vice News Tonight was going to be axed, paid themselves bonuses of hundreds of thousands of dollars. And you kind of
wonder, it's disgusting. Like, it's disgusting.
Yeah, you wonder like where, you know, where are the minds of those people who are working with those news journalists who are trying their hardest to get news out and, you know, rent the equipment from places in Brooklyn where that had stopped even allowing Vice to rent equipment from them because the bills weren't being paid. And, you know, what we saw in my former colleague, Kevin Dugan, wrote in New York Magazine about Shane Smith, the founder, winning an $8 million future salary. He's going to remain with the company. And I've been talking to all these journalists at the company, and they're just heartbroken and they're out of cash and they can't afford to put their kids in camp because they lost their jobs. And you just kind of feel for them. And, you know, the uptick in union activity, I think, is something that's going to continue. I've been very fortunate in my career in that I feel like I've been well compensated by the employers that I've had. And, you know, I've been able to, by myself, negotiate good deals. And, but it is clear that it's hard times right now. And I really do hope that we're in an expansion period again very soon, because it's not good to see what's happening in 2023. It's been depressing. But, you know, also the cutbacks at the tech companies, which have also been laying off people in the thousands, has a knock-on effect. So all of those deals that the tech companies might have done, marketing money they may have spent with people, just dried up. Amazon even looking to cut expenses. You've got Fox News and the Dominion lawsuit that resulted in them paying, you know, nearly $800 million in a defamation suit. All of those things mean that journalists at the bottom of the pile have to make do with less. And, you know, it's not just at Fox News, it's around the entire industry. What we're seeing is linear television viewing is declining. And that means there's less money for CNN, there's less money for NBC, there's less money for, you know, all of these cable news outlets, and even the broadcast networks too, CBS, ABC. When there's less ad dollars around and the viewing is moving somewhere else, the managers in charge have to cut back. And, you know, maybe the era of the $25 million news anchor, I think, is clearly over. And I think Matt Lauer was probably the last big star. Maybe Rachel Maddow is still in that category. But, you know, those big anchor salaries are certainly coming down.
It's really interesting to hear you talk, and I want to stick on advertising for a second because I think it's a really great parallel to this journalism industry conversation. And I'm glad you brought up Cannes. I know a lot of folks who were over there, to your point, and it does sound like advertising is coming back in 2024. I think the trick, right, is advertising is not coming back to media in the way that it did in years past, right? I think that these models have evolved to sort of leave these traditional advertising models out of newspapers, of television, et cetera, as you talked about. So if advertising is moving into a different place, the media is not there to cover it, right? And I'm curious what the vibe was there in Southern France, because without the media there to write about all this great work, it doesn't matter, right? At the end of the day, from a lot of what these companies are doing. So I'd be curious to hear, like, as you had those conversations there, like, how much of a, you know, sort of thread is there to what's happening in the media industry that also impacts what the advertising industry does?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, personally, I think that we in some ways talked ourselves into a recession, and that, you know, I'm pretty close to a lot of these advertisers and the chief investment officers at ad agencies. And, you know, they have to bring costs down, and, you know, they're looking for audiences, and inevitably the audiences are, you know, they're at big tech companies. They're not necessarily at media companies anymore. But that doesn't mean to say that I feel pessimistic, because I think with the launch of Threads, what Adam Mosseri, who was the founder of this new social media network that's attached to Instagram, said that he didn't really want, like, news people to be there or to be encouraged to dominate what Threads is, because brands want to be around something that's community and somewhat upbeat and not negative in the way that perhaps they viewed Twitter and brand safe. But what journalists bring and what the news media bring is engagement. We are always bringing an audience and a community around the things that we write about. And I think that's somewhat irreplaceable. Like, you can launch a new brand, but you want to be where eyeballs are, and they are typically around something highly engaging. And that's usually the news or opinion about the news. And I think, you know, Ben Shapiro is a huge star on Facebook. And, you know, what we're seeing is Megyn Kelly on Sirius, that these people can build a big audience based around opinions about what's in the news. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, my hope is that things get better, and that advertisers loosen the purse strings next year, and that things come back. I mean, I think there's always these periods where big companies need to shed lots of staff. They're usually the older, well-paid staff. And then people have to go on and think about, like, what's next for them. And that's certainly what I did. I decided that I wanted to do something that represented what my interests are. and my interests. I mean, typically reporters have to write to whatever the beat is that their editors assign. And my interest in media runs, you know, long and deep. I'm interested in all parts of it. And I was, in many of my roles, have been looking at a small piece of it. And, you know, when I was at NBC, everything had to come through a consumer lens. So the kind of stories I did there were very different from the ones that I did at Insider, which were about kind of who's running these big companies and are their strategies smart and what's happening at Warner, you know, who's in charge at Disney and that kind of story. And I think what we're seeing is, you know, Substack and a lot of other newsletter providers are seeing that if you're a journalist and people have followed you for many years and like what you do, you can create your own audience. And I certainly wrote a lot at, I worked on a desk at Insider where my colleagues were writing about the explosion of the creator economy. And that is individuals using social media. And not even, they don't even have websites. They have social media presences, most of it's video, where they can talk about anything and be specialists in something and find advertisers. And so a lot of the conversation at Canlu was about marrying creators with brands and finding people. Emma Chamberlain is one of these people. She was not on my radar before Cannes Lions, but now I know who she is. She's a Spotify influencer who I believe was into coffee and created her own like coffee brand. And so what we're seeing is advertisers going to individuals who've created a little following for themselves and co-creating brands or putting a new name on a product. And, you know, the creator economy is not exactly journalism, but it's a parallel to it. And I think we're kind of seeing more journalists realizing, well, I can be a creator in my own right and somehow create these audiences around what I do and still make a business of it.
Let's stay on that though, because I think that with any blessing, there's a curse, right? And so, yes, it's amazing to be able to strike out on your own, have a Substack. You know, I love your Substack. I read several other Substacks. For example, the first person that comes to mind is, I may get her last name wrong, but like Taylor Lorenz, or yeah. She has really kind of pioneered the art of being a real journalist and going her own way, and the opportunities have come her way. That comes with a tremendous cost. You know, the higher the profile, the more likely you are to get like unhinged people who hate you. But it's not only that, it's the fact that you can never stop producing. Like the pressure is on you because you are the brand, you are the product, and therefore you have to constantly be updating Twitter. For better or for worse, people are still on Twitter, and like building that following and responding to the people who post to you and also still doing the work. So I wonder about the sustainability of something like this, because at the same time that something like Substack or being your own brand or being a creator affords you that freedom and the ability to kind of name your price depending on your following, it's also tremendous pressure. I wonder about the burnout.
Yeah, I mean, this is something I'm new to. I launched my newsletter a month ago. And, you know, your show is about like kind of escaping the grind of the newsroom, right? And finding a new path for yourself. And you're absolutely right, Diana. What I'm finding is I'm currently in France. I need to get up and I need to see what's happened in the news, watch those CNBC interviews, make sure I'm up on everything, and stay current. And that is no easy job. And, you know, it's definitely not for slackers, I should say that. But what it has given me is the ability to be geographically free. And what my intention is with the new podcast and the newsletter is to roam around conferences. And I've been invited to an event in Qatar, one in Lisbon, and to just really get out there. And you know, I've been stuck behind on my kitchen table in my home in Hoboken, New Jersey for many years with COVID. And I feel this reporter's drive to be where the action is and get on planes and talk to people and be at the events and, you know, be part of what is going on instead of watching Twitter and watching social media. And, you know, we were talking about the big changes that technology has wrought. And I think one of them is that people forget that the phone exists. And I think that's partly because telemarketers have just invaded it. And there are so many, you know, weird calls that you get that people have just decided, I don't want to pick up the phone anymore. But a key aspect of journalism is not combing social media for people's posts. It is getting on the phone and it is talking to sources and it is being where they are. And I think that, you know, perhaps COVID and, young people communicate differently. They communicate on social and so communication channels have changed. But I feel like you're not really reporting if you're just reading what people are posting on Twitter and writing about what people are writing on Twitter. And the same goes for, you know, the producers at morning shows who get those great visuals from TikTok. And, you know, that's the funny story of the day. And, you know, sure, TikTok and social are showing us what's happening in the world, but it shouldn't really replace the journalism and the finding trends yourself and looking at research and talking to people and doing those, you know, the old school ways of finding out what's going on.
Real journalism. Yeah. No, that's not going to go away. This has been so tremendously, we could do like a 3-part series with you, Claire, but clearly the key is for everybody who's listening right now to go and subscribe to Claire's Substack and to listen to our podcast, because you were just a font of information and we've learned so much. But Lou had that first connection with you. So Lou, you get the last question. This has been just an absolute pleasure.
Thanks. Yeah, for sure. Thank you. I think it's interesting to me, and I'm going to stick to sort of what you learned in the last month or 6 weeks or 8 weeks, mm-hmm. as you've kind of branched out on your own, because I think that this is a common thread that we hear from other folks as they think about what is my life going to look like outside of the newsroom. So curious to hear your lessons about running a business, right? You're running a business on your own in addition to being the reporter. What is the lesson there? And also, you know, so much more that I think probably goes into this that I think people probably don't realize. So tell us a little bit behind the scenes. Yes,
absolutely. I guess the first part is it's really hard work. And launching a newsletter simultaneously with a podcast, I thought I would be leaving my job at Insider and having a little break, but things just kind of gelled and came together at the right time. So I literally didn't take a day off and I jumped right into launching both things. And, you know, what you find is that you don't know where the revenue is going to come from. But, you know, Mark Zuckerberg was always about find the audience first and then monetize it second. And so the big questions for me going forward is, how long do you do stuff before you need to see a certain level of replacement salary? I actually saved up my salary while I was employed in these jobs with the idea that I wanted to have a little freedom when my daughter went to college. That's happening in September. And so, you know, I've got a cushion and I've got a year to make this work. And I'm invested in the same way I was invested in it working when I was taking those pennies out of the jar when I first came to New York. I'm back in that same mindset now. And you have to have the success mindset that nothing is going to get in your way and that you are going to be a success and this is going to make you money. And, you know, my goal primarily, and I think this is the goal of most journalists, is that you want to tell the story. Like it's in you and you want to tell a story that you think people need to hear or understand. And that's the priority for me. And the money is definitely secondary, but it has to come in tandem with the heavy lift. And I think that most new jobs are a heavy lift, whether you're employed or whether you're working for yourself. I've had a career talking to people who built brands. I've had a career talking to people who are in the ad business and launched media products, and I've watched them do it. And, you know, I'm sure you feel that journalist frustration sometimes when you're listening to people, you're like, I can do that. I can do that. And so I'm doing it. And so we'll see what happens. And I feel incredibly liberated, and I feel like I made a good decision, and I'm, you know, thrilled to kind of share the story on your podcast, and I really appreciate you having me.
Claire, if the last 6 weeks or so has been any sign, I think you're off to great things here, and I really appreciate your candor and honesty here in the conversation. So we wish you nothing but the best as you kind of move forward. I think the work you're doing is terrific, and thank you again for making the time to join us. Have a great rest of your day.
Thanks, guys. Thanks, Lou.
Claire, you're the first guest I've ever taken notes during our conversation. I literally took notes during our conversation. Oh, you are so inspiring and amazing. So thank you so much.
Thanks. I hopefully I'll see things through to the end of the year. Hopefully I'll still be here. We'll be right back.